GoDaddy.com. Use the code BLU139 to get 10% off any combination of purchases at GoDaddy.com. See site for details. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com.
So my uncle, the only way to get into the car, he had to take all the back seat apart.
Tango Tango Papa 1281, February 21st, 2010.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Cheia de graça, ela, menina que vem e que passa, num doce balanço, caminho do mar. Moça do corpo dourado, do sol de Ipanema, o seu balançado é mais que um poema, é a coisa mais linda que eu já vi passar. Ah, porque estou tão sozinho? Ah, porque tudo é tão triste? Ah, beleza que existe, a beleza que não é só minha, que também passa sozinha. Ah, se ela soubesse que quando ela passa, o mundo sorrindo se enche de graça e fica mais lindo por causa do amor.
Tall and tan and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes, she walks, she's like a samba that swings so cool and sways so gently that when she passes, each one she passes goes, ah. Oh, but you watch her so sadly.
Thank you.
From Ipanema, referring to Rio de Janeiro. That's Rio de Janeiro suburb, Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Ipanema, it's a famous beach. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Disputanta, Virginia. Unloaded here earlier today. It took them several hours, you know, it took them a long time to unload my truck, which really didn't matter. So in any case, after they got it unloaded early this afternoon, I came, there's a truck stop about 3 miles away. Actually, there was an old truck stop that's across the street. It's still there, but it had limited parking and it was really kind of a dump. And so now there's a newer one, and I don't know how long it's been here. It can't have been here very long, but it's one of these, you know, it's kind of a more of a fuel stop type place, and it's got a Wendy's in it. It's one of these, you see these Wilco Hess truck stops. There's quite a few of them around anymore. And so that's what I'm parked in, and so I ate at Wendy's earlier. Actually, I ate there twice today. And so it looks like the next load that I pick up will be Monday at a place called Sandston, Sandston, Virginia, which is basically, it's looks like it's kind of a suburb, or it's somewhat east of Richmond. You know, because the name of the place I'm going to is Richmond Cold Storage, but it's located in Sandston, Virginia. And then that load delivers the following day at, that would be, I guess, Tuesday. It delivers Tuesday morning at Marietta, Ohio, which is in sort of, southeastern Ohio, kind of the more rural part of Ohio. And so that delivers up there on Tuesday. So probably, you know, I sat here the rest of the day, and chances are I'll just go ahead and sit here all day tomorrow. And then it's only about 35 miles from here up to where I'm going to pick the load up at. So I'll probably just go ahead and wait and drive up there Monday morning. Supposed to be there Monday morning at 10 a.m. And that's when the loading appointment is. And then after that, I'll drive on up to Marietta, Ohio, where it delivers at. So not a bad day today. The sun was out all day. I think the temperature when I got here this morning, the temperature was about, I don't know, around 29 degrees. And then it, I think it warmed up, I don't know, probably, I'm guessing, it somewhere in the low 50s, probably. And then this evening, I think it'll probably get down below freezing again. But after the all of the snow, you know, this seems like springtime, really. After, you know, all that snow I was in for the past couple of weeks up in Ohio, it really seems much warmer. And I think, I don't know, I was talking to my parents on the phone earlier this evening, and they said it had been 77. They're down, of course, they're down, I think, around Brownsville, Texas, far, you know, in far south Texas. And so it was, it got clear up to 77 there today, so they were really enjoying that, because it's even down there, they've had some cooler temperatures, you know, 50s and what have you, and that's a little cool for that area. And you know, all those are retirees go down there to try to chase the sun and stay warm, and I think some of them were complaining, hey, it's cold here. But you know, it's warmed up, so but you know, you can't have perfect, I mean, if you want more perfect weather, then you'd either have to go farther south, or you go to some place like Hawaii or something, and where it stays really nice all year round, and of course then you pay the price. But in any case, I've got a couple of pieces of audio that I want to play. One of them is from Irk. Irk does a bunch of different podcasts, and also Irk's mom Judy does a podcast. If you just go to channelirk.com, you can find Irk. And then I've also got this other, you know, I was kind of poking around, you know, because Irk's comment is about the, you know, I already listened to it. Irk's comment is about the topic of electricity. And so I was kind of poking around, and, you know, I was looking on Wikipedia, and they mentioned electric eels. You know, which is a fish, actually. It's a type of fish. It's not really an eel. It's a fish. But it actually produces its own electricity, which is pretty amazing when you think about that. It, you know, and an eel actually, this electric eel actually produces enough electricity to actually kill you. You know, it can kill you. You know, so it's not, you know, it's really quite amazing that biology can produce electricity, you know, that kind of electricity, you know, like, what'd they say, like 500 volts, you know, with enough amperage to actually kill, you know, it can actually kill human beings. It's been known to kill human beings and cattle and, you know, larger, you know, animals like horses, so on and so forth. So those things are a little dangerous. But I was looking, you know, I came across this film that was produced in the mid-1950s, and, you know, so I've got the audio that I want to play of that as well, because I thought that was kind of fascinating. But first of all, I want to talk a little bit about go to meeting. Excuse me. You have to meet with clients and colleagues face-to-face. The problem is, you may have a tight budget, and business travel is expensive and time-consuming. That's why I recommend doing more and traveling less by holding online meetings with GoToMeeting. For just $49 a month, you can hold as many meetings as you want. It's so easy, you'll have your first meeting running in seconds. Use GoToMeeting to collaborate with colleagues and clients and save time and money. You can try GoToMeeting free for 30 days, but you must visit GoToMeeting.com/podcast. That's GoToMeeting.com/podcast for a 30-day free trial. So, Irk was responding, you know, I played, you know, a few days ago, and I don't know, a couple of podcasts ago, I played a piece of audio that I recorded there at Wayne, Virginia, when I was doing the Walmart stuff. Last week, I was at Wayne, Virginia, at this Walmart store, and of course, it was dark at that point. It was dark by the time I got to Wayne, Virginia, to that Walmart store, and so I parked there next to the receiving area, and I turned my truck off, and I got out, and it sounded like running water. You know, there's this rushing. It was kind of a running water kind of a sound. And so I thought, you know, well, you know, there was a line of trees behind the store that I could see, and I thought, well, there must be some kind of creek or something back there that's making this running water sound. So I, you know, afterwards, the guy was, you know, I was coming out, you know, I came out when we were done, and he came out with me, and then I was reminded of that sound. And I asked him, is there a creek or something behind the store? And he said, no, the sound you hear is, there's these massive 500,000 volt electric power lines overhead. Excuse me. And so that's what the sound was. And it come to find out, you know, since I've read about it, they actually, these big, massive super high voltage transmission lines can be very noisy depending on the humidity in the air. If you know, less humidity, they may not make as much noise, but if it's really humid, or if it's raining, in this case it was kind of snowing a little bit and the humidity was high, and I think it was somewhat foggy, the thing was, it's actually static electricity that produces, you know, and it really mimics the sound that is produced by sort of like running water, but it's more like a, as I say, it's more like a white noise or a pink noise type sound, like when you're tuning an analog FM radio, you know, kind of in a in a place where there's no signal and it doesn't have any kind of muting. You know, if you have an older analog FM radio, then you get the shh type sound. And that's what this sound really sort of sounds like, the static electricity. And so in any case, Irk was, you know, sent this, this file to me earlier today. It's about 6 minutes and 45 seconds. Of course, Irk drives an electric train, and it's a commuter train, Sydney, Australia. And so he's kind of talking about that. So let's go ahead and listen to Irk.
G'day, Tom. It's Irk from Channel Irk, www.channelirk.com. Mate, I was listening to you talk about the other day the high voltage power lines and what noise they were making, and also the effects that being around that much electricity and the radiation, etc., could cause to someone. Now, at the moment, I'm in my train at the depot, just getting it ready because I'm on standby for AC/DC. Yes, the AC/DC concert on is a couple of kilometres away at the Olympic Stadium here in Sydney, and I'm basically here just in case they need extra trains. So I'm getting my train ready now just in case. Anywho, as you know, but some of your listeners may not know, I'm an electric train driver here in Sydney, Australia. I'm a commuter driver. You might think of it as a subway driver. And my trains are electric, and they receive the electricity from overhead wires, in my case, which are rated at 1500 volts DC. In other areas of Australia, the overhead is at 25,000 volts, but that's AC. When it comes to things like working on the tracks, working on the overhead wires, and also fighting fires near overhead wires, there are certain distances that you have to be away from the overhead wiring according to the voltage in the overhead wires. Now, we only have one electric system in Australia, which is in the ski fields, that is actually third rail, where the electricity comes through a third rail rather than overhead wiring. Whereas in the United States, for instance, on their subway systems, third rail is pretty much the way to go. However, in those circumstances, the voltage is usually around about 650 to 700 volts DC. The majority of the trains that I'm on have the DC, or they all have the DC overhead, and the traction motors are also DC. However, on the newer trains, they're AC motors. Now, in my driver's compartment at the moment on one of our older trains, I have about as much space in here as you do, Tom, in the cabin of your truck. If you were to divide your truck into half, not including your sleeper. And then that's the sort of area that I'm in. I've got a windscreen with four separate displays in front of me. And to my right-hand side, I've got a wall covered of circuit breakers for various things on the train, including lights, brakes, bells, heaters, air conditioning, and also controls for the compressors and the traction motors. All in told, in my little area that I have, which again is about the size of your truck cut in half, or your cabin cut in half, I have 34 circuit breakers in this particular area. And so in the cupboard next to me, on my right, and to the cupboard directly behind me, there's a lot of electrical cabinets. One of those we're not even allowed into anymore. If we need to do a procedure where that cabinet needs to be opened, we need to call the equivalent of road service, and they have to send out a tech to basically open that cupboard directly behind me because of the voltage in there. I don't know what extra training he's had, or, you know, he doesn't come out in a hazmat suit or anything. But I know over the years that there's been various blokes on the railways who have died from cancer. If that's been caused by all the electrics around us, who knows? But we certainly do have a lot of electrics in here. And that's pretty obvious if you've got something like 34 circuit breakers, you know, probably 15 separate buttons. You've got a public address system in here. You've got all sorts of wiring and all sorts of lights and everything in here. So you can imagine that I am surrounded by static electricity. Sometimes you hear it, sometimes you don't. And, you know, sometimes it is a concern. You think, you know, what is all of this electricity doing, you know, to my head? You know, to the little swimmers, let's put it that way. You sort of wonder what that sort of static electricity and, you know, the electromagnetic waves and everything, you have to wonder what's going on. And I could spend 4.5-5 hours per day in this basic little cubicle, if you want to call it that. So I wonder about that. It's definitely very interesting. I certainly don't want to be touching any overhead wiring. Sometimes I hear the noise from it in the circumstances that one of your listeners has already said. Sometimes I don't. I don't tend to give it much of a second thought, to be honest. The main noise is sometimes you'll get some weird and wonderful noises come through the speaker for the train radio or the public address system, and sometimes that causes a bit of havoc and you get some weird noises and all that sort of stuff. But loving the show as always. Keep warm. I definitely have to not worry about keeping warm. I have to worry about keeping cool. You know, it's a whole opposite thing. As always, you can find me at channelwork.com, and here's a horn for you, mate. There you go. Good night, Tom.
All right, so that was Irk, so thank you, Irk. Now, you know, the electric, you know, electricity, you know, I was reading the article on, you know, on Wikipedia about electricity, and it's been around, you know, people were aware of it, you know, centuries ago because of static electricity, certainly because of lightning. People were aware of it. They were aware that it could cause fires. They were certainly aware that if you got struck with lightning, it would kill you. It was around for a long time, and so, you know, until they figured out, you know, how they could actually harness it, you know, and then once they figured out that they could actually harness electricity and generate it and so on and so forth, and then they found, you know, and they could actually, when they came up with the idea to generate it and distribute it and sell it to people, then it became obvious that it could be used for many different things. You know, so, but in any case, at one time there was a kind of a war going on between direct current and alternating current. And some, you know, I'm going to read a little bit from this Wikipedia page about Thomas Edison, you know, because Thomas Edison was sort of instrumental, you know, he was one of the people that was instrumental in coming up with the idea of capitalizing on the, you know, he invented the electric light, and, you know, so he was one of the people that was trying to be, was really trying to capitalize on generating direct current electricity and then selling it. And so I'm going to read a little bit from the Wikipedia page on Thomas Edison. So this is, you know, it's electric power distribution. Edison patented a system for electricity distribution in 1880, which was essential to capitalize on the invention of the electric lamp. On December 17, 1880, Edison founded the Edison Illuminating Company. The company established the first investor-owned electric utility in 1882 on Pearl Street Station, New York City. It was on September 4, 1882, that Edison switched on his Pearl Street generating station's electrical power distribution system, which provided 110 volts of direct current to 59 customers in Lower Manhattan. Earlier in the year, in January 1882, he had switched on the first steam generating power station at Holborn Viaduct in London. The DC supply system provided electricity supplies to street lamps and several private dwellings within a short distance of the station. On January 19, 1883, the first standardized incandescent electric lighting system employed overhead wires began service in Rosselle, New Jersey. In the War of the Currents, Edison's true success, like that of his friend Henry Ford, was in his ability to maximize profits through establishment of mass production systems and intellectual property rights. George Westinghouse and Edison became adversaries because of Edison's promotion of direct current for electric power distribution instead of the more easily transmitted alternating current system invented by Nikola Tesla and promoted by Westinghouse. Unlike DC, AC could be stepped up to very high voltages with transformers sent over thinner and cheaper wires and stepped down again at the destination for distribution to users. In 1887, there were 121 Edison power stations in the United States delivering direct current electricity to customers. When the limitations of direct current were discussed by the public, Edison launched a propaganda campaign to convince people that alternating current was far too dangerous to use. The problem with DC was that the power plants could economically deliver DC electricity only to customers within about 1.5 miles, or that's about 2.4 kilometers, from the generating station so that it was suitable only for central business districts. When George Westinghouse suggested using high-voltage AC instead, as it could carry electricity hundreds of miles with marginal loss of power, Edison waged a war of currents to prevent AC from being adopted. Despite Edison's contempt for capital punishment, the war against AC led him to become involved in the development and promotion of the electric chair using AC current as an attempt to portray AC to have greater lethal potential than DC. Edison went on to carry out a brief but intense campaign to ban the use of AC or to limit the allowable voltage for safety purposes. As part of his campaign, Edison employees publicly electrocuted animals to demonstrate the dangers of AC. AC electric currents are slightly more dangerous in that frequencies near 60 Hz have a markedly greater potential for inducing fatal cardiac fibrillation than do DC currents. On one of the more notable occasions, in 1903, Edison's workers electrocuted Topsy the elephant at Luna Park near Coney Island after she had killed several men and her owners wanted her put to death. His company filmed the electrocution. AC replaced DC in most instances of generation and power distribution, enormously extending the range and improving the efficiency of power distribution. Though widespread use of DC ultimately lost favor for distribution, it exists today primarily in long-distance high-voltage direct current transmission systems. Low-voltage DC distribution continued to be used in high-density downtown areas for many years, but was eventually replaced by AC low-voltage network distribution in many of them. DC had the advantage that large battery banks could maintain continuous power through brief interruptions of the electric supply from generators and the transmission system. Utilities such as Commonwealth Edison in Chicago had rotary converters or motor generator sets, which could change DC to AC and AC to various frequencies in the early to mid-20th century. Utilities supplied rectifiers to convert the low-voltage AC to DC for such DC loads as elevators, fans, and pumps. There were still 1,600 DC customers in downtown New York City as of 2005, and service was finally discontinued on November 14, 2007. Most subway systems are still powered by direct current. So it's quite interesting, and there was quite a war that went on between, with Edison, between Edison and Nikola Tesla. There was quite a war that they waged, and one of the problems with DC is if you try to, and I think what really kind of turned the tables on Edison is that the fact that with DC, if you try to, depending on how you have your system set up, there is a fire hazard risk with it. And I think there was some kind of a fire that happened, and that really kind of turned the public, ended up making people think that the DC was more dangerous than the AC. So, very interesting. So, anyway, I want to play next this. I've got this audio from this film I found. It's actually, you can find it at archive.org, and it's about the electric eel. It was produced, let me just get this. It was produced by, the guy that you're going to hear talking in it. His name is Irwin Moon. And he produced a number of these films back in the, I think they were mostly back in the 50s and maybe some in the 60s. There was this organization called Moody Science. And I think it's Moody Science Institute. And so It's actually, I don't know, it's, some of these films from the 50s were actually, I don't know, there's just something interesting about them, you know, the look, you know, and the way that people talk. And you know that in these film, they're showing freeways with the, you know, the really old cars from the 50s and what have you. And but I don't know, the older films, you know, whenever you're watching television or you see some older film, you know, there's something I don't know, it's so different from today. Now, of course, one of the things from today, you know, when they produce some kind of a show or a TV show, you know, they're always showing you all these dazzling cuts and, you know, the screen's changing every couple of seconds. You know, they're flipping to a different camera view and it's at a much more frenetic pace. You know, so the stuff being produced today, there's certainly a different style, but in any case, this even though this was made in the 1950s, it's still very informative regarding the electric eels. You know, so, but I'll put a link to the actual. I'll embed the video. It's on archive.org, along with some other ones. I guess quite a few other ones. It's on archive.org, and you can actually find it. But and it along with the other ones, but. I'll put a link in, you know, I'll embed the actual video in the show notes in case you want to watch it. But one of the other things I wanted to mention while I'm thinking about it, I was reading, you know, I was kind of looking this Irwin Moon up in Google, and, you know, I, you know, went to a couple of different links, and there was this one, there's this one place where, you know, you can buy all the Irwin Moon films on, you know, on DVD, you know, like 19 DVDs for $120. And so this guy had written several paragraphs about these DVDs and how, you know, great he thought they were. And but he was saying, you know, even though they were produced in the mid 1900s. You know, I did a double take on that. Mid-1900s. You think, you know, of course, we're in the 2000s now, 2010. But you think, you know, mid-1900s. You know, wow, that sounds ancient. You know, because I've heard 20th century all my life, but, you know, mid-1900s. You know, I was born in the mid-1900s. You know, so that I don't know, you can you know most of the people alive today were born in the 1900s, if you think about it, you know, probably the vast majority. But I don't know, if you want to make somebody feel really old, you know, even if they're fairly young, you know, like if I see my niece, I'm gonna, you know, one or any of my nieces, I'm gonna tell them that they were born in the late 1900s. So anyway, I'm going to go ahead and play this. Now, this is about 11 minutes and 58 seconds, and it's kind of cool, because, you know, you get, of course, there's a lot of visual stuff, you know, if you, as I say, I'll embed the video in the show notes, you know, so, you know, it's really worth watching, because there's a lot of visual, interesting visual stuff going on, but, you know, you'll still get a good feel for, you know, and a lot of good information out of the audio. So this is, the fellow's name again is Irwin Moon, and he's talking about the electric eel.
I'd like you to meet a friend of mine. His name is Linnaeus. Electrophorus electricus, Linnaeus. Here at the lab, we just call him Joe. He isn't exactly what you'd call a raving beauty, is he? But he has his points. For one thing, he's quite a swimmer. Notice the wave motion of the long ventral fin. As the waves travel toward the rear, the eel is propelled forward. Reverse, the waves travel toward the head. How about ascending and descending? Well, to ascend, he merely starts waves at the center, which go both ways. And to descend, the waves start at both ends and work toward the middle. Joe is commonly called an electric eel. But actually, it isn't an eel at all, but a fish. of the carp or catfish family. Now, the eel part of his name may not be correct, but he sure came by the electric part honestly. There are stories of cattle, horses, even human beings being killed by the electric shock of eels just like this. In fact, along the Amazon River, ranchers have lost so many cattle that they have what they call electric eel drives. They herd the eels into shallow water and then they kill them with their machetes. Oh yes, they have insulated handles on the machetes. Now, of course, electrical impulses can't be seen. But if we put an electrode at each end of the tank, we can hear the electrical discharge on a loudspeaker. Now, those gentle pulses are part of the eel's radar system. In some mysterious way, he uses them to locate his food. Now, so far as we know, all adult electric eels are blind. They have heavy cataracts on their eyes. Now, eels feed on small fish, and if it weren't for this radar system, they'd starve to death. Now, when an eel locates a fish, or when he is disturbed, he puts out what we call the double whammy. This is a terrific shock that stuns anything in the water nearby. The only way you can describe Joe's table manners is to say that they're downright shocking. Eel, unlike most fish, is an air breather. It must rise to the surface from time to time for air. For this reason, he can be quite comfortable out of water. Now, the vital organs of the electric eel are all in the front 10 inches of his body. The rest is pure power plant. And believe it or not, he can generate more than 500 volts. Here we have a bank of 36 neon lamps. We'll connect these to our eel electrodes. Now, of course, the eel is designed to operate in water. His electrical system doesn't function too well in air, but even under these conditions, he should give us enough power to light the lights. For some reason, people seem to find it difficult to believe that a fish could put out any considerable amount of power. Even some of the folks here at the laboratory have been just a little bit skeptical about Joe's electrical prowess. And for that reason, we've asked a few of them if they wouldn't help us in an experiment. Will you have the group come in now, please? All right. Dave, you'd stand right over here, please. The rest of you just line up there. Be right over here, Mr. Humphrey. That's fine. Now, Dave, if you'll take this, please, and hold it in your right hand. Louis, you hold this one. That's fine. Now, everybody join hands. That's right. Now, you're connected in series. Now, there are five of you. That means that each of you will receive just one-fifth of the total voltage of the eel. Now, relax. We'll give you the low-voltage tap first. You ready? Did you feel that? Wasn't bad, was it? Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to have you meet a group of confirmed believers in electric eels. Thank you very much. Now, where did that electricity come from? Strange as it may seem, the eel's electric tissue is made up of cells very much like the cells that make up the nerves of our own bodies. These cells are called electroflags. Here is a crude model of one of these cells. Actually, the electroplaque is a tiny battery. 1/25 of an inch thick. Now, in a flashlight, there are three cells. Each cell generates 1.5 volts. Three of them in series produce the 4.5 volts necessary for the lamp. The Eales battery produces 1/10 of a volt. 10 of them in series will produce 1 volt. Well, at this rate, it would take 5,000 of these to produce the 500 volts of the Eale. Well, he's got them and then some. An Eale like Joe here probably has 250,000 electric cells. Connect them in series, 5,000 of them, and you have the 500 volts. The rest of them are connected in parallel to build up the current capacity. Now, each one of these tiny batteries has an electronic switch controlled by a signal sent along the nerve fiber connected to it. When an Eale wants to shock something, it throws hundreds of thousands of switches all at once just by thinking about it. But what to me is even more amazing is that when Joe's battery is run down, he can recharge them, all of them, in just 1/1000 of a second. That's quite a power plant, isn't it? The Eale's electrical system is composed of three main parts. The first is called the large electric organ. This is the source of the Eale's main voltage. Now, the function of this organ, called the organ of Hunter, is still somewhat of a mystery, although scientists believe that in some way it works with the large organ in producing the double whammy. This organ, called the bundle of socks, is to me the most wonderful. It has been definitely identified as the source of those mysterious radar pulses. In other words, this is the power plant for the Eale's radar transmitter. Now, of course, a radar system must have a receiver also. Do you notice those pits located in rows along the front part of the Eale? The other night I was in New York City talking with Dr. Christopher Coates, director of the New York Zoological Society. Dr. Coates is the world's foremost authority on electric eels. He performed an experiment recently that seems to indicate that those pits are a definite part of the eel's radar receiving system. Now, if Joe is willing to cooperate, we can perform a similar experiment here. The problem is to render Joe's radar system temporarily inoperative. Now, if we paint these pits with an insulating liquid, and if these pits have anything to do with the radar apparatus, Joe will find it very difficult to locate a fish. Well, we won't go hungry. This is a liquid that will wash off very rapidly. All right, so let's go back into your tank. That's right. Come on out now, like a good fella. Now, we want to give him a good supply of fish. All right, Joe is surrounded by his favorite delicacy, baby trout. But for the next few moments at least, those fish are just as safe as if there weren't an electric eel within 1,000 miles. You see, Joe's radar is on the blink. Oh, his transmitter's working all right. He's still putting out those radar pulses. Actually, it's his receiver that's not operating. Now, let's think for just a moment about what that means. To a certain extent, we can locate objects with our ears. We can tell roughly the direction from which a sound is coming. But you know, if I were blindfolded, I'd sure hate to try to catch a greased pig simply by listening to its squeal. But This problem, compared to Joe's, is relatively simple. You see, sound travels 1,100 feet per second in air. But Joe's radar pulses travel at the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second. This means that an electric eel's radar system must be able to interpret time difference that is less than 1/1,000,000th of a second. This is so amazing as to be almost beyond belief. Yes, Joe, you're quite a fellow. You may not win any beauty contests, but you've given us a lot to think about. You've given us a new understanding of the God who made us all.
Okay, so that was Irwin Moon, and that's from 1957. And he was talking about the electric eel. Very fascinating. You know, you think about that, and it's just using nerve. I think it, you know, like modified nerve cells to produce those voltages. It's just astounding that it's able to do that. That it's able to generate enough electricity to actually kill things, big things, horses, cattle, human beings. Utterly amazing. That's you know, you don't want to run into one of those things. Now, as far as I know, they don't exist in a lot. You know, they only exist in certain places, I think, like in South America and maybe parts of Africa. I think is the only place that those exist, but you know that you never know. But it's actually a fish, and it's related to the carp, like the carp family of fish. And you know, that would make you think twice. You know, if you were in a river that contained those, you would really think twice about you know, getting in the water. You know, and then I guess there are other creatures that have that ability. Think some stingrays actually can generate electricity, and there are other animals that are able to generate. You know, they generate far less electricity, but they're able. You know, like what did they say? Like certain there are certain fish, you know, like maybe sharks, that can actually detect, you know, they can sort of detect the presence of an electric field, you know, which, you know, and of course, obviously, if you've got a predator that is able to deliver that kind of a shock, or, you know, some kind of a, you know, a fish that's able to deliver a shock like that, then obviously you would have other animals that would be able to detect that, you know, as a defense. So, very fascinating. You know, it's really amazing when you think about it. You know, all of the technology that we come up with, generally speaking, biology has already got it. And they've already got a, you know, quite a you know, much more sophisticated version than what we can come up with. You know, we like to think that we have wonderfully sophisticated technology, and we've got all our, you know, our computers and our iPods and different computer chips and everything and so on and so forth. But it's really pretty clunky when you compare it to biology. You know, it's, you know, you think about this eel, you know, and in this film, you know, there was one part, and like I say, I'll embed it in the show notes, the video, the actual video, but there's this one part where he actually, you know, after he takes the thing out and lays it on the table, and of course he said it actually breathed this air, so it wasn't in any kind of distress, it was just laying there on the table. He took a couple of electrodes, you know, and connected it to a light a square light panel, and it actually made those light, they were just small light bulbs, probably 20 of them or something like that, set up in a square. You know, it was kind of a light panel with all these light bulbs, small light bulbs lined up in a row, and it actually made them flicker. You know, they actually came on, you know, sort of flickering. And of course he was saying that the animal is really set up to deliver far better voltages if it's in the water. Of course, this was just out in the air, he was careful not to touch the fish. You know, that's not a fish that you'd really want to touch. And how much you want to bet? I don't know. Do people eat those things? You know, I've seen eel on the menu, but I don't know if it was really an eel, because this is the so-called electric eel is actually a fish. But you eat seafood in different places, and they actually do serve eel, but I don't know that it's electric eel. But you wouldn't want to touch one of those things. You know, even if it was dead, I would still think that even right after it was dead, it would, you'd be pretty leery about touching it, because it could still easily probably shock you. Just amazing, absolutely amazing, when you think about that. So, but there's all kinds of animals that are able to do some extremely sophisticated things. Now, how can that be? How is it that animals are able to do that? You know, and you think, well, it's, you know, you get back to the argument, well, it all just happened. You know, it just kind of randomly happened, and, you know, just because it, you know, all the possibilities will eventually happen, and so it just all happened. You know, just, yeah, it happened. I don't think so. That's obviously, it's very intelligently designed. How in the world could something like that just arise from nothing? It couldn't. You know, it couldn't. So, you know, I can watch something like that, and it's just it's amazing. But there are people that really, you know, you get back to the argument of, you know, is there a God or is there not a God? Well, I know there's a God. Absolutely there is a God. It's obvious. I mean, it's obvious to me that there is. But you get to this thing, you know, where there's some people, instead of worshiping the Creator, you know, because they want to be God themselves, you know. So then, you know, they begin to worship the creation. You know, you have people that try to worship the creation as opposed to being able to just look at the creation, you know, kind of look at the creation, understand the creation, appreciate the creation, appreciate what went into the creation, what goes into the creation, what sustains the creation. You know, it's kind of, if you appreciate it in the right way, it's tantamount to worshiping God. You know, just, you know, eating something, you know, simple, like a piece of fruit, you know, like an apple. You know, it's amazing. And if you relate to that in the right way, that's tantamount to worship of the Creator. But, you know, of course, if you worship you could make a whole religion out of worshiping apples. You know, in the wrong way, and, you know, it would be like worshiping some kind of a statue or something, making an idol out of something. And, of course, people do that all the time in a myriad of different ways. Anything at all, and I do mean anything at all, can be abused. Anything at all can be misused. And we live in a world where that goes around us, it goes on around us all the time. And we ourselves, whether we want to admit it or not, we ourselves engage in that. We often engage in worshiping different kinds of foods, different kind. You know, it can be, as I say, it can be anything. Cars, ideas, people, places, things. It can be anything, and it is just anything at all. So, but in any case, I wanted to play that. I thought that was pretty fascinating, you know, about the electricity. And, you know, electricity is really a mysterious thing, because it's, apart from lightning, it's something that you can't see it. You know, unless it's burning something, you can't smell it. You know, unless you stick a 9-volt battery on your tongue, which I've never done, by the way. I know people, you know, one of my sister-in-laws will, you know, you hand her a 9-volt battery and she has no problem at all. So just stick it to her tongue to find out whether it's got any juice left in it or not. You know, so I've never done that, but, you know, it's an amazing thing. You know, you can't, other than what I was going to say, you can't really taste it. You know, you can't really smell it unless you set something on fire. You can only see it if it's lightning. But it's really, it's an interesting thing. You know, how does an electron travel down a wire? You know, you stop and think about that. How does that work? Wire, most metal is some sort of an electric conductor. How does that work? You know, that's, you know, if you really, you know, and I'm sure there are people that really study that and try to understand it. But if you just kind of think of it on a physical level, how in the world does that work? You know, it's really, really quite interesting to think about. But there's something kind of, even though we're familiar with electricity, and, you know, I'd say probably all of us alive at this point, there's, you know, even people that are very old, obviously, you know, the use of electricity dates back clear, you know, way back into the 1800s, late 1800s. So all of us that are alive today have, you know, electricity has existed. You know, man's use of electricity has existed. It really obviously came into fruition in the late, you know, the latter half of the 1900s. Boy, that sounds old. You know, from about 1950 onwards, the vast majority of people started getting electricity. But there's still something kind of weird about it and a little mysterious. You know, just the idea of, you know, those overhead power lines the other night. And, you know, electricity, we really don't, you know, because we use electricity in our homes, we don't really associate it with making noise, unless, you know, unless it sparks or something. But don't really associate just common, ordinary electricity as something that makes noise. And that, so, you know, that's just weird that those overhead power lines were making that noise. You know, that was the strangest thing about, you know, just really strange. It's really kind of a strange, mysterious, whatever it is. Well, when it comes right down to it, we really, you know, science likes to think that it under, you know, we're able to take things and do things with them, different forces, but do we really understand them? Do we really understand the real nature of things? And, you know, I don't think we do. Not to the degree that we like to think that we do. We as human beings like to think that we know everything, and of course we don't. We know, you know, you compare what we know with what's out there in the universe, and there's, you know, we probably know a fraction of a percentage of all that's to be known. You know, I watched another one of these videos, and the same guy, this Erwin Moon, he was talking about the light that we see from distant galaxies and distant stars. And I've talked a little bit about this before. You know, you look up at the nighttime sky, and you can actually see the Andromeda galaxy with the naked eye. It sort of looks like a little, you know, like a fuzzy something or other, like a fuzzy star or something, you know, just something fuzzy with the naked eye. You're looking at light that's a million years old. You're actually looking out into the past. When you look up at the night sky, you're looking into the past. The Andromeda galaxy could be gone, but, you know, it's probably still there. It's only a million years, and in the scheme of the universe, a million years is nothing. It's probably still there, but maybe it's moved a little bit. But we wouldn't know, and we have no way of knowing. The only way we know that it's there is because we've got this million-year-old light that from it that keeps shining. You know, there are stars that are millions of miles away, and then there are some that are, you know, that are less than that. But you know, the distances are so, we think of light as something that is almost instant, and certainly it is by our standards, the way we perceive time. But the distances are so vast in the universe that even light is just kind of inching along on a cosmic scale. You know, when you look up at the sun, you're looking at light that's 9 minutes old. You know, you look up at the sun, and you're looking at light that you're looking at the sun as it was 9 minutes before. You know, if the sun suddenly blew up, we wouldn't know it until, you know, we'd be vaporized 9 minutes later. You know, so it's really pretty interesting. You know, it's hard to wrap your mind around how large the universe is. And it's really, if you really think about it, it's pretty mysterious. The whole thing is a mystery. It's a huge, huge mystery. So, anyway, probably better be cutting this off. We're at 68 minutes. Hope everyone is having a great weekend. And I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.